The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're over in Oprah's digital magazine with the article, What We Get Wrong About the Five Stages of Grief. And this comes from the Lifestyle Wholeness section. The author of The Grief Cure explains why we cling to this philosophy and how real healing happens when we let it go. And this article is by Cody Delstrati. Before dropping her album, The Tortured Poets Department, this spring, Taylor Swift shared five intriguing playlists. Based on the Swiss-American psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Five Stages of Grief, each one included songs that grappled in some way with denial, anger, bargaining, depression, or acceptance. The denial playlist included hits like Cruel Summer and Lover. Anger had Dear John, Taylor's version, and Mr. Perfectly Fine, Taylor's version. Bargaining featured Cornelia Street and Death by a Thousand Cuts, and so on. There are few grieving philosophies more widely embraced in the U.S. than the five stages. There are also few that are so widely misinterpreted. Writing in her 1969 bestseller On Death and Dying, Kubler-Ross considered, in part, how terminally ill patients in a Chicago hospital grappled with their own death, not with how they grieved others. While one 2007 study in JAMA found that many do grieve in a progression that mirrors the five stages, they're often misinterpreted as a strict blueprint. When there are universal directions to grieve, one can, even should, follow. Kubler-Ross noted that this was not her aim, but the misunderstanding has mostly stuck. Indeed, the paradigm of contemporary American grief is one oriented toward an imaginary finish line. While researching my book, The Grief Cure, which I wrote in the years after my mother died of metastatic melanoma, one psychiatrist told me she had a patient who had been asking her husband to make her angry so she could get through the anger stage faster. This, said the psychiatrist, can hardly be considered functional grieving. Though it now sounds a bit outlandish, I can see where that client was coming from. Unmoored and uneducated about grief after my mother died, I also initially turned to concepts like the five stages and acceptance, not to mention closure. Their widespread nature provided me a shared language and then welcome expectation, a supposed endpoint to my grief. While I now know that so much of that is false, it's hard to overstate how pervasive and convincing these concepts are in the Western imagination. Closure is an expectation ubiquitous not only in TV and movie plots, but also in real-life relationships and national tragedies. One of the earliest uses of the term was in Gestalt psychology. In his 1923 paper, psychologist Max Wertheimer described how humans tend to perceive unfinished images as completed and whole, referring to this as the factor of closure. In an episode of Friends, Rachel complains to a date about not being able to get over her ex-boyfriend, Ross. "Look, I've been through a divorce. Trust me, you're going to be fine," her date tells her. "You just can't see it now because you haven't had any closure." Yeah, Rachel replies, closure. Then she maniacally calls Ross to tell him, I am over you. The concept of closure is everywhere, says Nancy Burns, a sociology professor at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, who wrote an incisive book on the subject that includes the Friends reference. And while there's nothing inherently wrong with wanting to get past the pain of loss, as with the five stages, trouble arises when closure becomes the principal objective, eclipsing the desire to grapple with one's grief. Because, in truth, there are no rules to grieving, no universal, linear modes. There are no hacks. Loss is personal and requires engagement. You can't march yourself onto a conveyor belt of five predetermined feelings and come out clean, clear, and closure/D on the other end. Grief is dirty, messy, intimate work. Real life doesn't have a credits sequence. Our stories must continue. Yet, after my mother died a decade ago, I found that some people didn't know how to do much of anything beyond implicitly push for closure. They'd nod and change the subject. They'd reframe my grief so as not to linger in its discomfort. At least you got to say goodbye. Soon it'll feel in the past. Anyone who has ever experienced a loss knows intimately this vicious cycle of awkwardness, pointing to your grief without ever embracing it. Ultimately, I found the push for closure and acceptance is rarely for the benefit of the bereaved. More often, it's about relieving those around her. This person may be struggling in her grief, goes the thinking, but if I can apply a positive spin, then surely when I am grieving one day, there will be a silver lining for me too. Far more powerful and comforting to the griever, however, is to admit the hellish nature of loss, to sit with someone, to allow that it hurts, to take your conversational cues from where the griever wants to go rather than where you might. There may be no acceptance, as it's typically understood. There may be no closure either. But there's life, to be held alongside death, hand in hand. Since my mother died, I've taken up a few rituals, both with others and alone. I annually rewatch The Lord of the Rings, the first movie series I saw in theaters with her. I have a scoop of Tillamook Mudslide, her favorite ice cream. I annually speak to a childhood friend who also lost a parent. And I read through the pages of my mother's gratefulness journal, placing myself inside her mind and remembering her through what she loved. These actions I'll be able to take for the rest of my life. They're not about assuaging the discomforts of those around me or getting to any perceived finish line. They let me keep her close without shutting the book. For Oprah's Insider today, we have Oprah and Gail on the power of women, and this article is by Oprah Winfrey. Oprah, guess where we are? Gail, on the road in Venice. Oprah, Venice. Gail, Oprah's first time. I've been here a couple times, and it never gets old. Oprah, it's my first time here, and we came here to celebrate with Diane von Furstenberg, for the Diane von Furstenberg Leadership Awards, where Diane had gathered women from all around the world who were doing extraordinary things in their lives. Gail, Prime Ministers. Oprah, Prime Ministers. Gail, former First Ladies. Oprah, yes, former First Ladies. Gail, climate activists. It's the 15th anniversary, so it's a big deal for her. Oprah, women making changes against domestic violence, reproductive rights, all the things that matter in the world, and just sitting at the table, being around all those women is so inspiring. You leave feeling like, I need to do better in my own life. Gail. And also, you leave in awe of women, too. What women can do, who we are, how we move in the world, and the changes we make, in most cases for the better. Oprah, most cases for the better, yes. And one of the lines I loved about women is they're looking for change, not just power, but looking for also change. And so inspired this week by being in the presence of people doing wonderful things. And I was just thinking about all of you being so supportive of us on O Daily. I want to know what inspires you, and what changes do you want to make as we come to the end of the summer? This is it. Gail, I know. Oprah, this is it. Gail, but it's been a good summer. Another line I liked from the lunch somebody said, it's not about passing the torch, it's about passing the truth. Oprah, yes. Gail, and that's what women do. Oprah, that's what women do. Let us know what you think. Gail, bye from Venice. Over in the books section, this article is Edwidge Danticat on her uncle's dementia. In her new book, We're Alone, the Oprah's Book Club author of Breath, Eyes, Memory opens up about the perspective she gained through her loved ones' lost memories. In the summer of 2018, my Uncle Frank, my father's youngest brother, wandered out of his house early one morning, disoriented. A neighbor spotted him and alerted my cousin Mendy, his daughter. My uncle was beginning to experience some signs of dementia. Suddenly, or perhaps not so suddenly, my uncle's past had vanished. An entire segment of our family history, of which he was the sole caretaker, was no longer available to us or to himself. Families, as my suddenly silenced uncle used to say, expand like ripples in a pond. Migration forces you to remake your family, as well as yourself. Family is not only made up of your living relatives. It is elders long buried and generations yet unborn, with stories as bridges and potential portals. Family is whoever is left when everyone else is gone. It is whoever is cleaning up at the end of the party or the funeral repast. It is that person who one nod might comfort you more than hundreds of words from someone else. Family members help you carry your dreams and memories. When I first heard about my uncle's illness, this was one among many others, I wondered whether he could still dream, and if so, what those dreams were about. His own dead parents and siblings? My grandparents and aunts and uncle, my father? His childhood home in the mountains of southern Haiti. His 4 decades spent as a factory worker, cab driver, and car service owner in Brooklyn, New York. His 7 sons and daughters. The final years he'd imagined as a proud grandfather embraced by a large brood of grandchildren, possibly even great-grandchildren. I wondered if his dreams were vivid, like movies of his own making. Did he also hallucinate and have night terrors? Dementia patients sometimes suffer from sundowning, evening agitation and restlessness. Could he also have been struggling with sun rising, when after a night of unease in the morning he would barely recognize what's real and what's a dream? Perhaps this was what drove him into the street at dawn. To think of sundowning and sun rising, though, makes it seem as though he were Fathon, dragging the sun behind him across the sky. Was it possible that my uncle could no longer recall his early struggling days in the United States, remember his fear of snow, or his many slips and falls on black ice as he was heading to work at a garment factory during the day, and to drive his taxicab at night? Might he have forgotten the births of his children or the death of his wife? Family legacies, my uncle and father used to say, are not only about traditions and values passed on from generation to generation. They're also about the actions we take or choose not to take. In the mountain village where my uncle and father were born, a single deed could mark or stain your family's reputation for generations, placing you in a hierarchy that, even if it was enforced only by gossip or shame, might still decide the fate of your progeny. I am not sure that's still true, but my father held on to that notion until his death, in part because it was taught to him by his father, who had learned it from his father. This is why he and my uncle had to leave the ancestral village and move to the capital, my uncle would say. Though neither he nor his siblings had committed shameful acts, they longed to start over in a new place where the generational burden was less weighty. Their new beginning was meant to be a reboot, though, not an erasure. I was with my Uncle Frank when he died in March 2022. I flew from Miami to New York to visit him. He had been bedridden and primarily unconscious for some time. When I walked into the hospital room, my cousin Mendy was singing him a Haitian gospel song he loved. I leaned over and, with my lips close to his ear, whispered, "Uncle, this is Noon-Noon, my family nickname. I came to see you." Tears rolled down his face, piercing through his half-closed eyes. I reached for his hands, his fists long balled by arthritis, and held them the way he'd held mine so many times when I was a girl. Mendy, who had been with him nearly every day for almost a decade of illnesses, offered to grab me a chair from the hallway. I accepted. When Mendy stepped out of the room, my uncle's chest rose and fell, and he stopped breathing. Though his ending felt abrupt, something about it was not. He was the last of his generation still alive. His death was both a beginning and an end. At 53, I had been thrust into becoming one of the oldest people on my father's side of the family. It had turned me into an elder. And there's a book that accompanies this article, We're Alone, by Edwidge Danicat. It's $26 at Amazon, $26 at bookshop.org, and $26 at Walmart. We're on the word of the week, emotional permanence. Out of sight, out of mind, this is the opposite, and it's much healthier. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Emotional permanence. We all know the phrase, out of sight, out of mind. Well, it shouldn't apply to your loved ones. Emotional permanence, also referred to as object permanence, is the idea that objects do not disappear simply because we cannot see them, says Aimee Lowe, a UK-based psychotherapist and author of the book Emotional Sensitivity and Intensity. At about 7 or 8 months old, babies come to understand that things still exist even if they don't see them. This is just as essential in adult relationships when the objects are other people. Emotional permanence is accepting that a partner still loves you even if they're on a work trip, or knowing your best friend has your back even though they're moving away, or feeling a parent's support when you're upset, even if they're, you get the picture. This comes more easily if you have a secure attachment style, meaning you felt safe and cared for in your early childhood and grew up with a strong sense of inner stability and trust in your loved ones. It can be a struggle for people with insecure or anxious, for example, less stable, attachment styles. For them, any distance, even a brief and innocuous one, may cause them to re-experience the childhood pain of being abandoned, disregarded, or disdained, Lowe explains. This fear may trigger coping survival modes. Think avoidance and denial, and on the other end of the spectrum, clinging. The good news is you can cultivate emotional permanence. It comes from understanding your attachment style and unpacking any potential relationship-driven fears. You may make helpful discoveries in therapy or on your own by reflecting on past relationships. And it's worth it. Emotional permanence fosters deeper empathy, less anxiety, more productivity and concentration, and stronger connections, Lowe says. It enables individuals to navigate life's ups and downs with grace and resiliency, fostering healthier relationships and overall well-being. This next article is in Work and Money. Are you paralyzed by money anxiety? If bills and budgeting make you want to bury your head in the sand, you might be what experts call financially frozen. Here's how to take action and regain control. This article is by Vivian Manning Schaffel. Brenda Belsanti, a 56-year-old from Wayland, Massachusetts, hasn't opened her bills in months. She was phased out of her longtime position in hospitality just before COVID hit and, because hotels weren't hiring during the pandemic, couldn't find another. A few unexpected tragic events further depleted her emotional and financial reserves, and although she eventually found a job in another field at a much lower salary, she still couldn't get out from under her mounting debt, no matter how much she budgets. This is unusual behavior for Belsanti, who says financial analysis paralysis was never her style. When I was a single mom, I always stayed in control of my finances, balancing my checkbook down to the last penny, she explains. I used to be able to live within my means because I knew what my bills would be every month. Aggressive inflation has engorged her debt further. Everything is so expensive now. I can't keep up. My debt isn't going anywhere, but I can't see a way out. According to a 2024 MarketWatch survey, almost 49% of Americans consider themselves broke, and 66% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. More than 100 million people in our country are saddled with medical bills they can't pay. The 2023 Stress in America survey from the American Psychological Association, APA, found that money and the economy were two of the leading causes of stress for more than half of the participants. Which explains why, when bills drop into our metaphorical mailboxes, so many Americans become paralyzed with fear. Financial freezing relates to our four physiologically wired reactions to stress: fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. There is something hardwired to freeze in us that says, don't move until you know what the next right move is, Amanda Clayman, a financial therapist based in Los Angeles, explains. When our bodies flood with stress hormones, our prefrontal cortex, the planning part of our brain, goes offline, and we become hypervigilant in perceiving danger, even if that danger is just a piece of paper that says pass due. Because there isn't a simple, straightforward path for us to put our energy toward. We end up putting it off, she adds. Financial psychologist Brad Klontz says the helplessness and hopelessness that come with this brand of overwhelm are often served with a heaping side of shame because financial strains come with a stigma. As many as 62% of participants in the APA survey say they avoid discussing their financial stress because they don't want to burden others. And 45% they say they feel embarrassed talking about money with others. So how can you take your blinders off and come to terms with your fiscal reality? Reframe your shame. Shame is an emotional glue trap that keeps you stuck, says Klontz. Sharing your circumstances and feelings with a financial advisor, therapist, or trusted friend can go a long way toward disarming shame's hold on you. just realizing that so many people are in the same boat is automatically sort of de-shaming in and of itself and can immediately start to unfreeze you, he says. Read on for a list of debt counseling services that can help you with next steps. Get physical. If even thinking about opening your credit card statement turns your stomach, Klontz says physical expression, yelling, running, can provide an emotional discharge to help shake loose uncomfortable feelings. Similarly, before sitting down to look at your bills, Klayman recommends taking a brisk walk or dancing around the room for 5 minutes to help your body process the flood of stress hormones. Movement helps animals process adrenaline, and basically we're animals, she says. When you finally sit to face the pile, take a few deep breaths to help you regain focus, says Dasha Kennedy, a financial coach who goes by the Broke Black Girl on Instagram. Take it one small step at a time. Kennedy says getting unstuck is a lengthy process that can gradually be tackled in tiny increments, just like a skincare routine. Improving financial hygiene requires consistent effort, she says. Schedule half-hour money dates with yourself in your calendar. Your first date could simply involve collecting all relevant financial documents, such as bills, statements, and account balances, to get a complete picture of your situation. Your second session could be devoted to identifying and prioritizing your immediate essential bills like rent or mortgage, utilities, and minimum debt payments to avoid penalties. Your third date might involve reviewing just one financial statement or bill at a time. Setting small, specific goals each day can make the process feel more manageable, she says. Use visual cues. Klontz says that not being able to see a way out of financial quicksand can perpetuate feelings of hopelessness and learned helplessness, keeping you stuck in the frustrations of the present. And that can keep you stuck in the frustrations of the present. To train your brain toward the potential of the future, he recommends using visual reminders of your financial goals, however and whenever you can. For example, you can name savings accounts for your goals. No more credit card debt or Greece 2025. Create empowering account passwords. Financial freedom 2025. And automate a portion of your paycheck straight into your savings. Ask a pro. For free professional advice, Kennedy recommends reaching out to nonprofit organizations such as United Way for free financial assistance and counseling services that can connect you with resources and support for improving financial health. She's also on the Financial Wellness Board for National Debt Relief, an organization that provides resources and counseling to help with debt management and overall financial health. The U.S. government also provides financial resources and tools through mymoney.gov, which offers guidance on budgeting, saving, and managing repayments. Ultimately, says Klayman, overcoming financial freeze requires reframing the effort as an opportunity to work on your personal growth more consistently, face your fears, and self-regulate the challenging emotions you've developed around them. Use money as a way to work on how to unfreeze yourself, because other parts of your life might be frozen too. We're in the styles section now. Wardrobe staples that will last forever. These 9 trend-proof pieces will give your style staying power. And this article is by Sarah Clousing. Trends come and go, but certain looks never go out of style. Designed with longevity in mind, there are a handful of clothing and accessory items crafted with premium high-quality materials featuring classic silhouettes that can be worn forever without the fear of looking outdated. This not only makes getting dressed easier, but it's also better for your budget. There's no need to buy tons of new items each season. And the environment, keeping things longer means less waste. Below, Oprah Daily creative director Adam Glassman breaks down the 9 items with sartorial staying power that every woman needs in her closet. A tailored blazer. Whether paired with streamlined trousers for work or with jeans and your favorite tee, nothing pulls together a look quite like a black blazer. Clean lines and a structured silhouette have made this tailored jacket a symbol of sophistication for decades. Hello, Katharine Hepburn. If you want it to last for a long time, look for a blazer with shoulders that are not too strong or oversized, says Glassman. A blazer should fit on your natural shoulder line. And they have 3 suggestions here for you. One is at H&M, single-breasted blazer. It's $40 at H&M. And one from Nordstrom, the Nordstrom 1-button blazer. And it's $111 at Nordstrom. And the last one is Theory Carissa 2-button blazer. And it's $265 at Theory. Of the 3 blazers, the H&M is the shortest one. The Nordstrom one is longer and goes down, it looks like, to the top of the thigh. And the Theory Carissa blazer, it is a bit curved in the bottom on the front. A classic watch. Watches are jewelry that's appropriate every day and for any occasion, says Glassman. Two-toned styles are the way to go, as they work with all your other arm candy. And yes, you can absolutely mix metals. By investing in a quality watch, you'll have an heirloom that can be passed down from generation to generation. Glassman notes, "My general rule of thumb, a good haircut, watch, and a pair of shoes will take you far." They've listed 3 options here. The first one is Casio Quartz Dual Tone Watch. It's $48 at Amazon. It has a round face, is silver in the center and gold on the outer edge, and it's $48 at Amazon. The next is Breda Relic Analog Watch. It is silver with a small square face and little gold pieces of the center of the band on either side in between the silver. It's $195 at Urban Outfitters. And the last one is Michael Kors Runway 2-Tone Watch. And it has a round face with gold behind it. And again, a silver band with gold running down the middle. It's $275 at Michael Kors and $250 at Amazon. And all of these watches have metal bands that look like they are stretch bands. A button-down shirt. Repeat after us. Every woman needs a great white button-down shirt. It's an effortless essential. When in doubt, you can never go wrong with a white shirt. Period. End of subject, asserts Glassman. It's the workhouse of your closet and can be worn casually, professionally, or even for evening. Not sure how to wear it for a fancy event? Glassman suggests pairing it with a ball skirt. Unsure as to which fabric to choose? Cotton, silk, and linen are all quality options that tend to last the longest. Plus, you can't go wrong with a version with some stretch in it. It helps with fit, wrinkles less, and is ideal for travel. Bonus tip, if you find gapping to be an issue, Glassman recommends purchasing a size up and tailoring the sides or adding a few small snaps between the mid-chest buttons. And again, there are 3 options. The one that's the shortest in length is an Abercrombie Poplin button-up shirt. It's $60 at Abercrombie. The second one is AYR, the Deep End button-down shirt. It's $135 at AYR.com. And the last one is Vince Convertible button-down shirt, $206 at Vince. And there isn't a great difference except length. The Vince convertible looks to be a little bit longer than the other 2. Loafers. While black loafers may be having a moment, they have always been in vogue. The shape and silhouette add polish and refinement to any outfit. whether your look is dressed up or casual. Glassman notes that loafers are also not season-specific. Like the white button-down shirt, you can wear them at any time of the year. If you take care of them well, loafers will stand the test of time. Plus, they will always come with great cost per wear because you will have them forever. The three options that they are listing, the first one is Mark Fisher Lilithia Black Leather Loafer, and it's $70 at DSW, and it looks like a traditional loafer and even has the slit where they used to put coins in, I believe. The second one is G.H. Bass Whitney Super Lug Sole Penny Loafer. This one has more of a heel on it. It's $185 at Nordstrom, $185 at Bloomingdale's, and $175 at Urban Outfitters. And the last one is Flattern, has a much more pointed toe and like a metal bar decoration on the top. This is a Gucci Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-A-N, bit leather loafer, and it's $920 at Nordstrom. A cashmere sweater. While you may not be thinking about cashmere right now, a super soft V-neck or crew neck sweater is the perfect layering piece that you can throw over your shoulders for unexpectedly breezy summer nights. Glassman adds that scoop or V-necks tend to flatter most body types, especially those with bigger busts. You can wear your cashmere sweater layered, think of lighter weight options as alternatives to a tee, or on its own, day or night. There's nothing chicer than a cashmere sweater paired at night with a dressy skirt, says Glassman. The three options, the Quince Mongolian Cashmere Sweater. It's tan and has a crew neck with long sleeves. It's $50 at Quince, Quince.com. The second one is Nadam Original Cashmere Sweater, N-A-A-D-A-M, and this one's navy blue and a crew neck as well with long sleeves, $98 at Nadam. And the last option is a J. Crew Cashmere Crew Neck Sweater. This one looks like a three-quarter sleeve and is an off-white color. It's $128 at J. Crew. Diamond Stud Earrings. Diamond stud earrings are a rite of passage for every woman. They hold significant value in terms of style and worth. Large or small, they look refined and classy paired with jeans and a t-shirt, but can also add nice sparkle to a cocktail dress. And while this accessory is on the higher end of the price point scale, Glassman notes that you really can find a pair for every budget. The larger you go, the more expensive a pair is likely to be. But a small pair can still look substantial in the right setting. Diamond studs bring a lot of lightness to your face and will last for generations, says Glassman. You can pass them on to your children on their wedding day or even your grandchildren. Three options again. A smaller pair, Mejuri Bezel, M-E-J-U-R-I, and the second word is B-E-Z-E-L, round diamond studs. They're inset in gold around them, $598 at Mejuri. The second option is a little bigger, also round, with set in gold. Light box lab-grown diamond bezel studs are $1,000 at lightboxjewelry.com. The last option is by Ben Bridge Signature 18-carat diamond stud earrings, and they look like they have three prongs that are silver color, and they're round as well. It's $1,999 at benbridge.com. A little black dress. The little black dress, often referred to as the LBD, has rightfully earned its place as a must-have wardrobe investment. To make sure it works for almost any occasion, it's all about homing in on fabrication and silhouette. Shop a fabric that has lasting power and wrinkles very little, like wool, gabardine, crepe, stretch cotton, or jersey, says Glassman. Then choose a length and silhouette that suits your frame. Sheath, wrap, and A-line are all terrific shapes that can easily be worn professionally, for date night, or dressed up for evening glam. The goal is to find an LBD you love and then style it with flats, sneakers, or heels. The three options are the BTFBM pleated midi wrap dress. So this dress falls about mid-shin and has short sleeves that are nice and full, $33 at Amazon. The second dress is the Somerset Collection by Anthropologie tiered maxi dress. This one goes down to almost the ankle, and it's $168 at Anthropologie. It is also short sleeves. The last one is another Tomorrow fitted tee dress. This is a long straight dress, goes again about mid-shin, and has short sleeves and a crew neck. $230 at Another Tomorrow. A trench coat. A well-designed trench is an outerwear investment that has exuded sophistication for decades. With a long line silhouette and belted waist, this style flatters all body types and is actually functional, wear it rain or shine. Glassman notes that outerwear generally is the most splurge-worthy category, but that splurging on a quality piece is worth it because it is the type of coat you'll wear over and over. They are entrance makers and exit makers. They can make a look or complement a look. A trench belted over leggings or skinny jeans and a tee or turtleneck is always in fashion. Our first example is from the Drop Noah NOA Belted Trench Coat. It's an off-white coat. It has two buttons on the ends of each of the sleeves and has double-breasted buttons in the front, and it's $100 at Amazon. The second example is London Fog double-breasted three-quarter length belted trench coat. The example is black, and it has a silver buckle on the belt, and it's $77 at Amazon. The last one is the Everlane Renew Long Trench Coat. It's $290 at Everlane, and it is a khaki color with a button decoration on the end of each sleeve and double buttons in the front. A timeless handbag. Everyone needs a great black bag that works for all four seasons, says Glassman. Before you purchase, be honest with yourself. A good rule of thumb is to ask yourself if you will wear it at least 2 days of the week. If the answer says yes, it's a good buy. Look for enduring styles like a top handle, hobo, or crossbody that have structure, clean lines, and are made from premium materials. Investment bags often have the advantage of retaining or expanding their value over time, making them both stylish and savvy purchases. Of the three examples, the first one is Made Well Mini Shopper Tote in leather-trimmed straw. And it looks like black leather is the trim on it, and it has a thin strap, and it also has handles. It's $72 at Madewell. The second bag is K. Carroll Accessories Kelsey Cross Body Bag. It's teal colored, and the strap has a buckle on it for it to be adjusted, and it also has a handle. It's $45 at Amazon and $329 at Walmart. The last one is the Lululemon Everywhere Belt Bag, and it's white, small. It's $38 at Lululemon, $217 at Amazon, and $70 at Walmart. Over in culture and news, Lady Gaga offers first clear look at her giant diamond engagement ring. This article is by Alyssa Bailey. Just a little over a month after Lady Gaga revealed her engagement during the Paris Olympics, the actress gave the first clear look of her ring to photographers. Gaga and her fiancé, Michael Polanski, were photographed arriving in Venice yesterday ahead of the September 4 premiere of her film, Joker, Folie à Deux, during the Venice Film Festival. They matched in black, and Gaga flashed her giant oval diamond ring as they walked past paparazzi. The couple was also photographed kissing. News of Gaga and Polanski dating first broke in February 2020. Engagement rumors began in April 2024, although the couple remained mum. On July 28, French Prime Minister Gabriel Attal posted a TikTok of himself meeting Gaga at the Paris Olympics. Polanski was with her, and she introduced him to Attal as her fiancé. The couple has kept most of their relationship private. A source told Entertainment Tonight on July 29 that they are happy, and Polanski proposed months before Gaga shared the news. Lady Gaga and Michael have been engaged since the spring, the source said. They're both extremely happy and excited about this moment in their relationship. The focus for Gaga publicly will be the Joker sequel these next few months and the unconventional love story it tells. The star plays Harley Quinn in the musical. In late July, she spoke to Variety about what to expect from director Todd Phillips' movie. Todd took a very big swing with this whole concept and with the script, giving the sequel to Joker this audacity and complexity, she said. There's music, there's dance, it's drama. It's also a courtroom drama. It's a comedy. It's happy. It's sad. It's a testament to Todd as a director that he would rather be creative than just tell a traditional story of love. Still in culture and news, how long has Al Roker been on the Today Show? Fans may be surprised to learn this. The NBC host has been on the hit daytime series for almost three decades, and he says his road to getting there was pure luck. This article is by Adriana Friedman. If you ever turn your TV on to catch a taping of the Today Show, you may be familiar with seeing Al Roker on your screen. The longtime TV anchor has a reputation as the NBC daytime series resident weatherman, but he's also one to not just stay in his own lane. Al loves to report on other stories that are important to the audience, along with having a good time with his equally well-known Today Show hosts. Whether he's cracking jokes with Craig Melvin, dramatically reacting to Hoda Kotb and Savannah Guthrie's on-air debates, or causing a hilarious reaction from Chenille Jones. He's always one to keep an eye on throughout an episode. But given how even we remember seeing the newly minted cookbook author on our televisions growing up, this has us wondering about the answer to one major question. Exactly how long has Al Roker been on the Today Show? Given how he celebrated 45 years of working on NBC back in December 2023, we were surprised to learn just how long Al has been a part of our TV lives. How long has Al Roker been on the Today Show? According to NBC Insider, Al's first episode of the hit morning show aired on January 26, 1996, meaning Al Roker has been on the Today Show for 28 years. When speaking with Business Insider in August 2020, Al said he originally began his career with NBC back in 1978, when he worked for the station WKYC in Cleveland, Ohio. He eventually came back to his native New York City for a job reporting the weekend weather for NBC. Frank Field, who was the preeminent weatherman in not just New York City, but probably the country, decided to go over to Channel 2, he told the publication. So I got the Monday through Friday job. If I had not been in position to get that job during the weekend weather with NBC, I don't know where I'd be today. Since then, Al has been a friendly face on the Today Show, and he does way more than just the weather. He also is a staple with Hoda and Savannah during the annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, where he follows the excitement of both the live audience and the celebrities taking in the festivities. While Al has been a part of the Today Show family for a long time, there have been periods where folks didn't see him. When he took time off from the daytime series to recover from being hospitalized for blood clots in his leg, his January 2023 return had everyone emotional. "The crew is weepy," Hoda said at the time in a clip posted on YouTube. "The crowd outside has been waiting for you. They've been bummed every day we've walked out there. They're like, where's Al? I have missed you guys so very much. You are my second family, and it's just great to be back and wearing pants, Al joked. Here's to seeing Al on our TV screens for a long time. Again in culture and news, reasonable doubts Emma Yahtzee Garibaldi on her fiercest role yet. Playing a tough-as-nails lawyer weathering personal and professional storms, she kind of represents all of us. This article is by Jane Burnett. After appearing in TV hits like Max's Ballers and The Young and the Restless and Ava DuVernay's 2012 film Middle of Nowhere, Afro-Latina actress Emma Yahtzee Garibaldi is playing determined mother and laser-sharp Los Angeles defense attorney Jax Stewart in the Hulu drama Reasonable Doubt. Her character faces challenges in her marriage, family, and romantic and platonic relationships, all while managing an intense job and the aftermath of major personal trauma. Garibaldi's character is loosely based on real-life celebrity attorney Sean Holly, known for her role on O.J. Simpson's defense team and representing clients ranging from Michael Jackson to the Kardashian-Jenner clan to Justin Bieber. Holly is a co-executive producer on the show, while Kerry Washington and Larry Wilmore are executive producers alongside Scandal writer Ramla Mohammed, who is also its creator and showrunner. The show proudly boasts an all-black writer's room, as well as all episodes being spearheaded by a black director. You can see Garibaldi in action during the trailer for season 2. We sat down with the Kentucky-born star to find out more about her role in the buzzy series. Turns out it mirrors a version of the legal career she once dreamed of before her aha moment that acting was her true calling. What sparked your passion for acting? From a young age, I always had an interest in people and why they do what they do. My father was in the military, and we moved all the time. I was always making new friends, meeting new people, and having to make sense of the fact that I had to leave the friends I'd just made. So I made up stories about people, my friends, since I didn't know what happened to them after I moved. Like, I think maybe Sharon ended up moving to Hawaii and becoming a surfer. I would literally get in bed. It would be time for me to go to sleep, and that would be my time to create and play in my world. It wasn't until high school that I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. But when I understood why I wanted to be a lawyer, which was like, oh, you just like the arguing in the courtroom, the outfits, and the drama. Once I put that together, I said, oh, no. Okay, I think I want to be an actor. I made that firm decision in high school and went for it after that. What's the biggest thing you hope viewers take away from this series? Domestic violence is one of the main storylines. Jax has to represent her friend, Chanel. How did she not know? How did she not see this coming? How did she not know that it was as deep and as bad as it was? And how that affects her relationship with her friend? At the same time, she's trying to support her through a time like that. I'm hoping that people experiencing domestic violence are able to watch the show and, number one, get help. If they see themselves or someone they know reflected in any kind of way, I hope they're able to find the resources and get help. And then, in the first season, Jax is formidable, in control, powerful, successful. But in the second season, she's much more vulnerable, broken woman after enduring a tragic loss. How does she rebuild herself from that? I hope people see Jax's journey and realize that it's okay to put yourself first and practice self-care, however that may look, like therapy, journaling, going to the beach. Taking a moment for self-care after you've experienced a traumatic event is important. How has this role impacted you personally? It has reminded me of my strength, my power, and my abilities as a woman given how many things we go through and have to navigate on a daily basis. Women tend to have a running tally in our head of things that have to get done, from taking care of kids to the groceries, the laundry, to work. I don't think men have that same mental tally, that mental load. So it has reminded me to give myself grace because I'm doing a lot. I'm doing it all. I'm doing it well. That in itself is a success. How was working with Kerry Washington, who selected you for the lead role? She's very hands-on. She cares about the show, the character, and about me. She's made sure that I know that she's right there for me, championing me the entire way. It's been wonderful working with her. She's a real advocate. What do you know for sure, even if you don't have proof? Oh, wow. 1,000 things just jumped into my head. What I know for sure is that things will always work out exactly as they should, even if I don't have the proof at that moment. Here's a book recommendation, The Winner by Teddy Wayne. Connor O'Toole is fresh out of law school and strapped for cash when he accepts an offer to teach tennis to a lawyer in exchange for free housing in a gated community near Cape Cod. He figures he can drum up extra clients during the day and study for the bar at night. Enter Catherine, a glamorous, brazen divorcee in her 40s, hoping to improve her forehand. At least that's how it starts. As their secret fling heats up, Connor starts to fall for a bookish younger woman he meets on the beach. But the control and discipline that got him through law school and intense tennis matches starts slipping away, and then, in a shockworthy twist, he commits a crime that throws an already precarious situation into complete disarray. This book is $24 at Amazon, $28 at bookshop.org, and $30 at Walmart. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.